Shot him in the back, 'cause it's a crime to be black. And don't you act surprised when it gets vandalized. So call it what it is, call it what it is, call it what it is, murder.
Alright, thank you for joining us here on another episode of the White Privilege Podcast. I'm your host, at Very White Guy, and today I'm joined by Sean Jordan, who's on Twitter at Sean J. Jordan. You can find this podcast at Interracial John, that's JAWN.com. You can also find us on iTunes, Stitcher, the podcast app, here are the places. Just search IRJ Presents White Privilege, or I think even just White Privilege Podcast, or Interracial John, White Privilege, and you should find us there. But Sean, thank you for joining us on Christmas Eve. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you for having me. And I just want to point out, today is December 24th, and on November 24th, the grand jury announcement was released here in St. Louis about Darren Wilson, who shot Michael Brown. And it's crazy to think that in that month that's transpired, so many things have happened across the country, across the world. And it's also crazy to think that police have continued to kill black people in this time. In fact, we just had a murder last night here in the St. Louis area of a guy named Antonio Martin, and we're still trying to figure out exactly what happened, because it looks like he was murdered, and then the police tried to pin him for having a gun that he may not have had, and they released camera footage that was unclear as evidence. It's crazy.
Yeah, and let's actually talk about that, because I don't know if I'm totally in the loop. I was up. I think the extrajudicial killing happened at like 1 a.m. It was pretty late, and some stuff started coming out, and then that video so one, there's a body camera and there's a dashboard camera, neither of which purportedly were recording, so that's questionable. The video they released was from like, you know, hundreds of feet away, almost around a corner, really not that hard, not that clear and able to see what's going on. And they used that video as sort of a indication that, okay, Antonio drew a weapon, he was shoplifting, he pulled a gun and he pointed it at the police officer. And from what I can tell, the Antonio was there for 2 hours. People are, you know, some of the tweets I'm reading are saying that it took him a couple hours to even find the gun. The image of the gun that we're being shown is from, like, you know, in a box in the trunk kind of thing. It just all seems very strange. And when we take all of this in context of, we know that the narrative machine, the media and the police, they're not just prone to lying, that they've been caught in numerous lies to support their sort of narrative of this is what happened. And even the press conference this morning said he pointed a gun, we have the video, and now you're seeing the AP Newswire saying he pointed a gun and he was killed. And it's like there's no police statement from we don't know who shot Antonio. We don't have the area being treated like a crime scene. Antonio's body was there for hours. I'm hearing reports that he was perhaps breathing after a shot, and they sat around and didn't even call the ambulance. I mean, all of this stuff it just doesn't sit right, and it just seems so fishy. And, you know, already all my, you know, conservative, I don't want to call them right-wing nut job friends, but on Twitter, on Facebook, everyone's coming with the, you know, point a gun at a cop and what do you expect? You're going to get shot. Shoplift, point a gun, you're going to get killed. And it's driving me nuts. I don't even know what to think.
Well, I discovered it at about 7:30 this morning when I woke up. I actually crashed pretty early last night, so I slept through all of this. And the first thing I saw on my Twitter feed this morning was the St. Louis County Police Department releasing a video. And I watched the video a few times, and I honestly just saw a bunch of people going in and out of a gas station.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell what was going on in that video and what I was meant to be seeing. And so I went looking around, and it became very clear to me very quickly that the people that were saying that the video was proof that something had gone down were living in a deluded fantasy world, because the video didn't show anything. Maybe if you look at it squinting or zooming in and looking at squiggles on the compression, what it maybe showed was a guy raising his arm with something in his hand. That's as much as I could see. But I went looking at, you know, people that were actually on the scene, and I haven't found anybody that was actual eyewitness. There was somebody that was a bogus eyewitness that's already been outed. But there were actual people that came to the scene right away, and one of them is a Ferguson protester named Wise Chef. I won't say his real name because he goes by Wise Chef. But he's one of the dominant voices in the Ferguson movement. He lives a couple blocks away, and he ran down and started taking video and taking pictures. And there were cameras everywhere at that gas station. I mean, they were everywhere. He took pictures of a corner that was right next to where Antonio Martin got shot that showed there were at least four cameras on that corner alone pointing in every direction. So there was no reason that they had to show us a video that was from far away that seemed to show somebody holding up his arm at most as evidence. They should have dead to rights evidence on why Antonio Martin needed to be shot and killed by a police officer. And instead what they showed us is something that's unclear and vague. They handled the crime scene in a way that was clearly determined to close up the transparency rather than to be transparent about what was going on. They basically treated the people that were on the scene like protesters immediately. They came out with assault weapons and tasers and things like that ready to go. It's unlike anything that you would imagine a crime scene would be. The way it was handled is unlike any way you would imagine a crime would be handled. It's just completely insane. And for people to be coming out and saying, oh, well, this is so clear-cut, how can you be against this?
Yeah.
Well, it's really not. It's really not. And I think as we learn more about it today, we're going to find out that there's a lot of nuance here that that may suggest that what the police said happened isn't exactly what happened at all.
No, and even the phrase crime scene, I think, is, you know, I might take umbrage with it. It just doesn't seem like when black people are killed by police that they look at that as a crime. It doesn't seem like they treat it like a crime. They don't act like it's a crime. They don't have the, you know, Internal Affairs Division and other detectives, independent people come in and interview the officer right there. They do none of that stuff, you know? They even go back to Mike Brown. There's this discrepancy. How far was he from Darren Wilson's SUV? Because nobody friggin' measured it. Right? In a real crime, if you're treating like a crime, you go out with the investigative unit and you make measurements and you take pictures. I mean, the one photographer said his battery was dead. Come on. You know? So when and what drives me nuts is what you just said, is that people are taking this, and I think that that video is a little bit of a dog whistle. It's a deliberately vague, hard to see anything, and it's ambiguous so that, you know, quote unquote, moderate whites can say, oh, you know, he pointed a gun, he was shoplifting, he deserved to die. And even, you know, I go back to all of these instances. Okay, so he had a gun. Okay, so he pointed at a cop. Does that mean he needs to be executed in a barrage of bullets? You know, it's crazy. The whole, it's just, and we talked about it the other day on my podcast, this narrative of, you know, the police are infallible, they're without, you know, they're perfect. They never do anything wrong. They never make any mistakes. There's no vested interest in protecting their own. There's no vested interest in avoiding civil liabilities and prosecution and going to jail. There's no interest in that at all. They're just completely infallible. And even the people that were telling me, oh, the AP, you know, says he pointed a gun, I started really thinking about that. Well, what does that mean? Did the AP, was someone from the AP Newswire there on the scene? Probably not. Did someone call the AP, maybe like a PR agent for the police, and relay a story, and then the AP writes that as if it's, you know, factual, when it's really just hearsay? We don't know anything.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And, you know, I actually have a background in journalism, although I did not work professionally as a journalist for very long. I actually was disillusioned by a lot of what was going on in the journalism industry even 10 years ago or 15 years ago when I was considering making that my career. And one of the things I can tell you absolutely is that as a journalist, what you do is you go out and you try to find official sources. And journalists are usually concerned about trying to find three sources in any story, one that is on one side of the issue, one that's on the other side of the issue, and one that's kind of neutral. And in crime scene reporting in particular, they're looking for an official source, an eyewitness source, and maybe a source that has some commentary. And so they try to incorporate all three. It's not honest, and it's not reflective of the truth. And often news reports of incidents like this are very vague, and they're very misleading. And until some real reporting has been done and some real investigation has been done, these news reports give the slightest of information, and often winds up being inaccurate information. And this can be a problem. Conspiracy theory nuts a lot of times will point out, you know, let's talk about September 11th, for example. A lot of the early reporting on September 11th differed from what was being said later because reporters didn't really have a lot of information, and so they were just running whatever they could. well, conspiracy theory nuts often will look at that and say, see, the story changed as the government got in there and changed things. Well, it was just that the reporting was inaccurate. But that happens all the times in these kind of cases, too. When Michael Brown was killed back in August, a lot of the early reporting about him was incorrect. And it took about a day or two for things to really get ironed out. When Von Derrick Myers was killed back in October, the same thing. They didn't even know his name. They kept spelling his name wrong or saying that he was younger or older than he really was, or saying that he died in a different part of St. Louis than he really died in. And it took a little bit of time for that reporting to be straight. So I don't trust any reports that I see this morning that come from anyone other than someone that was on the scene, because the people that were on the scene were taking pictures, they were taking videos, they're saying things that actually happened from their point of view, whereas reporters, who knows where they're getting their information from.
Yeah, and what their vested interest. I don't want to bash Christine DeBiers, but my God, you know, I don't even know what she does. Is that reporting or is that disseminating press release statements for the police department? It doesn't seem like reporting.
Well, there certainly is an element to that particular reporter's style that seems very pro-police. And, you know, I can't say what any individual journalist or reporter does, but I can say that she exhibits a pattern that seems to be very sympathetic to the police and very uninterested in talking about any other sides of the story.
You're a better man than me, Charlie Brown. That was well said, Sean. I wouldn't have been as polite. Well, I wanted to talk, and we had planned before Antonio's extrajudicial killing, talking about a few of the things, and I want to kind of delve into it, and I'll be honest, it's a little bit selfish for me. So as a white person working within this space, there's a lot of emotions, I should say, you know, things that are going on internally for me. I wouldn't say I'm newly awoke. I've been married to a woman of color for many years. I've been, you know, understanding, compassionate, and you know, active to a degree. But admittedly, Mike Brown's death, extrajudicial killing, murder, really changed me in terms of my approach. I became much more active. So my, you know, level of work within the social justice and activism ramped up significantly. And the more I've been doing it and the more I've been in it, there's all sorts of weird, as a white person, weird kind of emotions for me. And I don't know if you've been feeling some of these same things or, you know, whether you really want to talk about it. But so one of the things that really highlighted this for me was the Miss Tui, and I can't remember her first name. I keep wanting to call her Sandra, but it was Sandra Bullock that played the character in the movie The Blind Side. So Miss Tui was the woman that adopted the young black man that now plays for the Baltimore Ravens. You know the story I'm talking about, right?
Yes. Leanne is her name.
Leanne, thank you. So yep. She had posted on social media this, you know, picture and this whole little sort of story on Facebook and, you know, oh, I was at one of my restaurants and two black men were kind of huddled over talking and a friend of mine said, I bet they're up to no good. And I said, let's go over there. And she sat down and she sat in silence for a few minutes and then she finally asked the boys, so what's going on? And she talked to them a little bit more. And then sort of the end of the story is Leanne sort of posting, you know, I ended up giving them bus fare and, you know, tickets, money for the game. And, you know, this is how it should be. And then she's got a picture of sort of these two young men with her arms around him. And almost immediately there was a bit of a backlash, a thread from some bloggers that were sort of like, yeah, you know, Miss Tui, this is kind of, you're breaking your arm, patting yourself on the back for, you know, quote unquote, not being racist. And some of the action was sort of weird. Like, you know, you just sat down in silence. These two young men probably thought that was very strange. You kind of confronted them. But then it got even more, I would say, interesting when one of the young men posted almost a rebuttal to the Facebook post saying, hey, listen, this isn't how it went down. We were just sitting there waiting for the time to end so we could, you know, pick up a relative. And, you know, we had money for the game. That wasn't an issue. We were three blocks from the stadium. So I don't know why she would think we needed bus fare. Just sort of, you know, like dispelling this sort of story, I should say, that she was presenting. And it got a lot of people talking in a couple different groups I'm in about, you know, white people and our motivations, and there's always a little hint of wanting to look good, you know, wanting to be perceived as somebody that is doing the right thing. And sometimes that motivation can kind of, you know, for lack of a better word, mess up our ability to do good. So here's, you know, a situation where maybe Miss Tui could have said, hey, you know what you just said about those boys up to no good? That's kind of racist. Let's talk about that and talk to her friend and leave these two young men alone. Instead, she kind of said, let's make this a photo op. So tied up in that is this kind of, you know, is it the white savior complex, white knight syndrome? What's the way of describing that, Sean?
Well, first of all, I do want to qualify anything I say by saying that anyone that has even a hint of celebrity that goes and does an action like that, I question their motives from the get-go, because in this age of instant social media exposure and things like that, a lot of times when people are doing this is to keep their name current in the headlines. So I just want to qualify anything I'm saying by that. But I have observed a lot of what you're talking about with people that are not celebrities. So I can comment on that very specifically. And let me offer an example of something that I saw just recently in my own Twitter feed. So I retweeted a person of color that said something to the effect of, "Hey, white people, it's great that you're supporting us now, but please make sure you support us in the future, because my grandparents remember a time where you supported us and then stopped supporting us, and I don't want to see that happen again." It was just a pretty benign comment. I thought it was pretty reflective and pretty insightful. And immediately, a white person who calls himself an ally jumped on that thread and started telling the black person, "Well, I'm not going to abandon you. I'm going to stick with you. I'm going to be with you," and got confrontational with the black person for saying this. And it got very heated in a very short amount of time, because this person decided that they needed to make it known that they are out there to support black people. And I see that kind of thing happen all the time. And, you know, I know you've talked about this a lot on the White Privilege podcast. I know we've talked about this a lot on Twitter. This is a very real problem that is due to not just what we call white privilege, but also this sort of feeling that, we as white people sometimes don't want to be identified with the rest of our race or our group, because we feel like we're better than them. We feel like, oh, we're taking steps. We're doing the right thing. We're being good people. So we don't want to be lumped in with the people that aren't being good. And so we take personally something that maybe we shouldn't be taking personally, but we also like want to elevate ourselves even above our white privilege. And that to me is a really peculiar problem, that instead of lowering ourselves down to be in that submissive state that Charles Wade was talking about in an earlier episode, we want to elevate ourselves even above the privilege that we already have to say, well, I'm not just a person that has white privilege, but I'm a person that is putting my privilege to the side so I can help you lowly black people. Mm. When I see things going on like that, it really bothers me, because that's the exact opposite of where we need to be as supporters. And like yourself, I'm not a fan of the term ally. I really would not like to use that term to describe myself. If a person of color describes me as an ally, I'll be happy to accept it. But for myself, I just prefer the word supporter. I think that that's more accurately what I do.
Agreed.
But to see people that want to take that as a badge of honor and to use that as sort of their 15 minutes of fame, that to me is a very troubling trend, and it's something that we see all too often. Whether you're talking about supporting Ferguson, whether you're talking about the Eric Garner I Can't Breathe movement, whether you're talking about some of the protests that have been going on around the country, there's been an awful lot of that that's erupted, and an awful lot of it that has resulted in dissension among protest groups, from people that are legitimately out there to talk about Black Lives Matter, and then people that are legitimately out there, I think, just to try to make a name for themselves or get retweets or to build a persona that suggests that they're better than other people of their race.
Interesting. And I saw it at the Philadelphia protest, where there was a die-in and there was instructions. It was supposed to be at this time. And a bunch of white folks started early and they were getting all this press. And then the leaders, the individuals of color, they say, okay, the real die-in is going to start over here, the different part of the train station. And so the die-in starts. And I swear I saw these two guys with a giant Black Lives, huge, like 8-foot banner, pushing people over, almost like bumping into women and children and black people, like just so they can hoist up their banner, Black Lives Matter. And I thought, what are you really trying to do? Do you really care about black lives, or do you care about being seen as someone who appears to care about black lives? And where I struggle with that is that on the surface, so, some of the examples we've given, it's pretty obvious that it was the, Mantui and the people with the sign and some other things you mentioned. It's like, okay, it's clear you're doing this for the photo op, right? You're doing this for the pat on the back, for the appearance, rather than the central cause that Black Lives Matter. But sometimes, and in particular with Twitter, and I'm a bit of a Twitter addict, and I really am bad with it. I'm on it way too much. But so there's this tendency to, when I step back and I say, okay, let me check myself. What am I doing? How am I doing these things? Am I aware of my privilege? Am I, centered in this movement in the right way? you could, you know, distant third observer, look at what I do on Twitter, you know, the very white guy handle and other stuff, and it looks a lot like somebody who's doing shit just for the perception, right? It's like, do I really know? Does very white guy feel this way, or is he just trying to gain followers? So I struggle myself with, you know, what are my motivations? What, you know, how am I doing this? And I don't know if it was on this podcast or the other ones, but I mentioned, you know, me personally, I was at a protest action where I was kind of on my phone. I just really wasn't present to the, you know, what we were doing at that moment. And a young woman said, I bet he's a cop. And it just, you know, like broke my heart that here's somebody that thinks I'm a cop, right? I'm not that cops are so bad that I didn't want to be thought of as a cop, but like I was so arm's length away and not present in that moment that somebody on the surface looked and said, oh, here's someone who's, you know, he's not even here. He doesn't care about black lives. He might even be a cop. And I really had to sit with that and say, man, you know, when I'm at these marches and protest actions, I don't pull my phone out at all anymore. I'm very present to the, you know, the emotion and what we're doing and the purpose. But it was something I had to learn, right? And I had to sort of, okay, well, you know, why am I at this protest action? Is it to, you know, tweet it and get photos and, you know, people to say this or that? So for me, there is sometimes a little, you know, I'll be honest, ego is in there. You know, I want to be perceived as somebody that does the right thing and cares about black lives. And but then I want to actually make a difference, and I want to do work and activity that makes a difference. So sometimes there's this weird interplay where I kind of want to do more, and then I'm worried about what am I doing and how is it perceived. And then when I don't do more, because I have a day job and I've been not doing well with my day job, but you know, then I feel guilty that I'm not doing more. And it's all really kind of bizarrely twisted, and at least for me emotionally. And I feel like I'm dumping this on you, Sean, because I can't literally talk to my black wife about this. I'd almost feel like abusive talking to her about my own emotional struggles working within this space. It seems cruel to ask her to talk to me about that stuff, you know?
Well, first of all, let me say I'm happy to be your therapist in this regard.
Thank you.
Even though I'm not licensed to be one. But more than that, this is a conversation that a lot of white supporters have been having. And you know, part of my what I try to do specifically through Twitter, because that's where I do a lot of my public work in trying to aid others, is I try to reach out to white supporters and help them to find their role in the movement. And when I say the movement, I'm not just talking about Ferguson, but just the broader Black Lives Matter movement that we're all kind of becoming a part of. You know, throughout the country in the last few weeks, I mean, we had Brandon Tate Brown, we've had Tamir Rice, we've had Akai Gurley, we've had there's a guy in North Carolina whose name escapes me for the moment. All over the place, there are movements that continue to spring up, and you know, we as white supporters have to figure out a way to play a role in that, but we also have to be mindful of how we're being perceived in that role so that we can be effective. Now, the first thing that you said was, you know, you realize when you go to protest events that you need to put your phone away. And that's something that I would recommend to anyone. There is a definite perception among regular protesters, black or white, that there are a lot of people that just show up to say, hey, I'm at the Ferguson Police Department, you know, I'm here to protest and, you know, take a few pictures and then to leave. And they are suspicious of those people. They're suspicious of their intentions. Are they just here to join the bandwagon for a few minutes and leave? Are they here to scope out the scene and see who's here and so they can report back to the police? Are they just here because they're here to disrupt or to be an instigator? So there's always suspicion of those folks. So the best thing you can do is to put your phone away, to really participate in what's going on, to really show that you have a passion and a concern about what's going on, and tweet about it later. Talk about it later after you've been through it and you've had some time to reflect on it. That means a lot more for supporting the movement. And then another thing to think about as well is when you're on Twitter, are you saying things with the intention of trying to get retweets, or are you saying things with the intention of honestly trying to provide some value to the movement? So this is something that I have to check myself on as well. When I started out in August, I barely used Twitter, and I had 80 followers, and I think about half of them were just Twitter bots that showed up and were following me for arbitrary reasons. Now I have almost 2,000 followers. Well, I don't really pay that close of attention to my followers number because that's not important to me. If I only had one follower, it wouldn't matter to me. So long as what I'm saying is truthful and helpful and is generating some kind of value for the movement. And those who follow me have seen me go through a real transformation over the last few months. I used to get up and pound on the pulpit and say things that I thought were true based on kind of my academic knowledge of a lot of these issues. And admittedly, my academic knowledge is not as deep as it could be, but I had some ideas and I had some theories that I was putting forth. And I've really backed away from that, and I've gotten more to talking about, here's what's going on, here's who you need to listen to, here are the voices that really are speaking truth in this movement, and here are some perspectives that I have, just kind of analyzing things, but here's who I want you to really listen to if you think my perspectives are correct.
Mm.
And that's helped me to focus on elevating the voices that really are powerful and that are, you know, often people of color that are saying really smart, intelligent, on-point things without making myself the story. I'm just kind of guiding people rather than being the voice myself. I'm guiding them to listen to the voices that are the people that I would tell them after months and months of listening to them are really on target. And I think that's what I recommend to a lot of supporters is try to amplify rather than to try to be the person that's telling other people what to think. Try to demonstrate solidarity without trying to make the solidarity about yourself. And try to donate things that are useful. You can donate money, you can donate gifts, you can donate cards, you can donate time, whatever it is that you donate, something. And if you do those three things, you're helping. And it doesn't matter if you're doing those three things for an hour a week or an hour a day or several hours a day. As long as you're doing them, you're adding something to the movement.
That's really well said. And I probably, like you, have been through a bit of a Twitter evolution. I almost never used it before, maybe like June or July, and I just started getting interested. I kind of got it, right? Like I was one of those Twitter people that made an account in 2008 and had like an egg avatar for 4 years and didn't do anything. And I finally was like, okay, let me, you know, do something. And I actually had changed my Twitter handle to Very White Guy somewhere in the summer. And we were talking about podcasting. I said, oh, that'd be a good sort of handle for the podcast and, you know, kind of what my platform is in terms of a white male of significant privilege. I prefer to speak from that perspective and primarily to and for and about other white people. I don't really have a frame of reference or perspective to speak of, about, or to people of color at all. So a lot of what I've been doing has always been, you know, about, you know, white privilege and white people and implicit bias. But as the movement has progressed, and I maybe am guilty of doing more of the of what you said in the last piece, being the mouth rather than amplifying someone else. But maybe that's, you know, I'll have to reflect upon that in terms of where maybe that might be a point at which I'm feeling some of this consternation because I'm not amplifying others in that sense. But so I've grown some followers, and like you, I've really had to start kind of changing how I use Twitter. You know, I don't tweet about, you know, How to Get Away with Murder and, you know, other TV shows I used to watch. I've kind of stopped doing that simply because I don't think it's appropriate for the platform that now is there to really, you know, what am I doing with that time? It really is no longer TV shows and pop culture. It's kind of this movement 100% and really Black Lives Matter 100%. And even you said something earlier about people kind of, you know, well, you know, that's not me. I've instituted a couple of rules. And one is if you come with any version of not all white people, I just block. I really, you know, I'm getting close to that with All Lives Matter. You know, with All Lives Matter, I'll sometimes, you know, reengage with centering on Black Lives Matter and why that's important. But frequently I just, you know, block or unfollow that person or mute that person. I don't have a lot of patience for not all white people. It's kind of frustrating.
Yeah, well, and you can't even – it used to be that you could look at someone that was saying something to you and you could go and kind of look at their bio and their picture and say, oh, they seem to be a person of color. Maybe they're speaking from a point of truth and I just haven't considered their point of view. Well, now there are so many Twitter trolls that we think are police or police wives that are using black people's avatars and bios and trying to pretend to be people of color so that they control you. And so it's gotten to a point where many of us just by default, because we get trolled so often. And by the way, anytime I mention Bassem Masri, who's a friend of mine, anytime I mention him on Twitter, I start getting trolled like crazy. It's amazing. They really hate him. But I just block. I don't even listen to them anymore. In fact, this morning, before I even got my second tweet out about Antonio Martin, I was getting tons of trolls who were all saying, well, didn't you watch the camera footage? Didn't you see what the camera had to say? And it almost seemed like it was coordinated to me. Like they had gotten together and organized at 4 in the morning, and they were going to start trolling every single one of us that would say anything about this issue. And, you know, there's really only about 100 of us that really actively tweet on these topics. But it's like they had a list, you know, in a spreadsheet somewhere, and they were just going to go and hit us all as quickly as they could. So it's gotten to a point where with Twitter, you know, I've gotten to the point where I just say, you know what, I use it to share ideas. And I use it to collect information. I do not use it to debate people. I'm not interested in debating people. I don't care about debating people that have a different point of view from me. I can point them to the facts that I've looked at, and they can look at them themselves. But what I care about is engaging people. And yeah. Debating and engaging are two very, very different ideas. Debating means that we have a different point of view, and we're going to try to convince each other that our point of views are valid, whereas engaging is saying, here's my point of view. You can take it or leave it, but this is what it is. And I'm much more interested in doing that.
Yeah, and you'll like that. And I don't know if I sent it to you, but I started a new Tumblr. So we had there was the Ferguson Response Tumblr that was great, and it's still active. There's the MLK Day of Action coming up. So it's got all the different events across the country. So if you're looking for somewhere in your city what you can do, you know, whether it's a march or different protest actions specifically surrounding MLK Day, FergusonResponse.tumblr.com is a great resource. So I borrowed that. I thought, hey, this is a great tool. So I called it Ferguson Responsibility, and I'm calling it sort of, you know, supremacy is our, meaning white people. It's our creation. It's our responsibility, and it's going to require our action. And I initially was thinking that it would be events and ways for people to kind of in a public space, whether there's, you know, like a showing of mirrors of privilege or, you know, a reading of Ta-Nehisi Coates' article. And I think that was maybe too I was aiming too high. So now I'm putting together a series of memes. I'm hoping to get dozens and dozens of just images that highlight racial bias, you know, in a systemic way. And then the tagline, let's talk. And I really am hoping that white folk will find it, and I'll attach it to the end of this podcast. But FergusonResponsibility.tumblr.com, and just post one of these memes and invite people to talk. We just got to start talking, you know. And I think that I hope that in starting a dialogue and inviting someone to the dialogue, it won't just be this polemic rhetoric from two ends, but it'll create a space where people maybe kind of in the middle, and they don't really know, and maybe they're not really sure, can actually have a dialogue. And I tend to agree that in 140 characters, that's difficult, nay, impossible. And even the dialogues I have had, when I thought, okay, here's somebody that's rational, and we go further down, okay, we're in agreement. The most recent one I had, somebody said, and we went back and forth and back and forth, we agreed on the racial disparity in a multitude of data points, you know, mass incarceration, you know, profiling, so on. And I said, okay, great. So now my hypothesis, this disparity is because of an implicit racial bias and an inherently, you know, racial system. And she literally came back with, oh, no, I think black people are more prone to violence. I think black people are more ignorant. I think black people have statistics. They've got more STDs. It was just like, ugh. There was like, you know, here I thought I was having a reasonable dialogue. And it got down to the end, and the end was, she's got horrible opinions on people of color. Whether you call that being a racist, you know, whatever you want to call it, it was just, why'd I waste my time, you know? So I'm hoping that with this sort of invitation to a dialogue, we'll get people that actually want to talk versus troll.
Well,
it
is a wonderful site. I actually took a look at it this morning because you mentioned it to me before we started recording. And I'm a researcher. I am a professional researcher. That's what I do for a living. And I love breaking things down into data points. And I often say that, you know, going back to my background in journalism was about looking at two or three points of view and writing them into an article and saying, well, the truth lies somewhere in the middle. As a researcher, I have a different point of view. I like to get at least 30 points of view. That's what it takes to achieve what we call a normal distribution. And then build on that and look at the data from a large sample of people rather than just a handful of anecdotal pieces. And what you're presenting here on Ferguson Responsibility are data that have been analyzed, they've been verified, they've been validated, and they're true. I mean, they're reflective of the culture in which we live in. And, you know, some of the statistics that you have up there, black men are 21 times more likely than white men to be killed by law enforcement officials. That is true. That comes from there are several different sources of that statistic, but it is absolutely true. And it's something that has been verified and validated, and that's inarguable. In fact, the only thing that is arguable about that statistic is the fact that it might actually be more than that because of the way that reporting is done on these crimes. So you can go and check that out and find out that it's indeed true. 57% of black high school students have access to advanced academic courses compared to 71% of white high school students. Well, as a researcher, I can tell you that when you're comparing two statistics, you have to be careful about what's called a margin of error. But that's a very big difference. Mm. And so that's way outside the margin of error that we would be looking at. That is an actual disparity. And a disparity is something that means that our culture is favoring one group over another. Well, supposedly, in the 1960s, we got rid of that. And supposedly, we lived in a post-racial society, if you believe that talking point. But the statistics tell a different story. They tell that the gains that we've made since the 1960s are not that significant, and that the post-racial society idea is a myth, that it continues to be a problem. And whether you want to chalk it up to institutional racism, which I think is a big factor, whether you want to chalk it up to a number of historical events that have led us to where we are today, whether you want to chalk it up to just a feeling of apathy in our culture, I think all of those are factors. But we still have a lot of work to do. And having statistics like this to talk about and to discuss is much more useful than debating opinions about whether or not someone was holding a gun in a grainy video. Statistics are something that we can really sink into and talk about in a real way.
And that was my hope. And with each meme, with each image, you can click on it and get the actual data point from where that, the URL of the research, whether it's Pew or, a government link. But so there's not just this data point, but there's actual information where that was gleaned from. And I thought about putting more information in, and I sort of thought, that should be the onus should be on the person inviting this dialogue. If I'm going to post a picture that says, black men are 21 times more likely to be killed by law enforcement than white men, I should be able to discuss that elegantly. I should be able to, point to that statistic and why it's true, and be able to have some knowledge about it. So I didn't want this just to be hashtag activism where people just putting up pictures. I wanted somebody to say, I'm going to put this picture up and invite a dialogue. And in doing so, I know I need to be educated. I need to do some learning on my own. So I'm hoping it does a few things. I hope it spurs white folks. And there's so many of these racial disparity statistics. I hope that there'll be vertical niches of them. So if I'm a nurse, I can find one about healthcare. If I'm an educator, I can find one about the education system. If I work in a different sector, I can find one that, I'm willing and able to think and talk about. So I hope that we get a lot of those examples and that people use them and spread her out, because we've got to have this conversation. And I deliberately used racial bias because I've been kind of toying with, having these dialogues. I've been attempting to have these dialogues. And good, bad, and different, racism, racist, white privilege, supremacy, they're triggers for white people. And when they hear that, there's this sort of instant, you can see it on their face, a wall kind of goes up. So I hope that racial bias is a little bit, and I'm not trying to, equivocate and soft shoe it for white people. I'm not trying to spoon feed it in a way that they can digest. But, if you're inviting a dialogue, I'm hoping racial bias is one that people can come into without having their defense mechanisms up and ready to go. Because that happens a lot when I talk about racism and supremacy. And, I'm not calling you a racist, but this is a racist system. And if you're okay with it and you're apathetic and you don't care, well, then that's a problem, So it's a bit strange having these dialogues, but hopefully this will allow it to, happen more organically and more often, because my God, we white people we just got a lot to do. And that's part of where I feel this sort of guilt and I want to do more. And then I start thinking, well, who the hell am I and why should I do it? And, is this, am I trying to be the white savior? And, so I get kind of all, weird in my feelings. And then even, we didn't talk too much about it, but there's an emotional component, I watched and I was talking with Drumbeats and, yesterday in Basm, and we were talking about the video that came out of California from the Elks Lodge, where they took the song Bad Bad Leroy Brown and they put in new lyrics about Michael Brown, and it just was such a trigger for Leslie. She just literally burst into tears. And so here I'm
talking with her, and I can't feel the same way she's feeling about this. You know, she's internalizing this in a way that I'll never be able to because I'm not black. But, you know, I'm emotional, I'm upset. But then I start thinking, well, God, I'm a white, you know, cis hetero male. I'm like winning the lottery. What do I have to be upset about? I'm just, you know, these emotions are, someone called it second string pain, right? Like tertiary mm-hmm. pain. But it's still kind of real. And again, I'm dumping this on you because I can't talk to my wife about it, and I don't have any additional white activists nearby that I get to talk to on a regular basis. But it's just weird. I'm in a strange space with this movement. I don't know if I'm effectively balancing work, life, health. I have not yet quite realized that this is likely going to be a lifetime's work, a generation of work, and I'm not acting like that. I'm acting with a sense of urgency, and I'm feeling like I'm going to burn myself out, but...
Well, the good news is, if I could offer some good news and all of that, I completely understand how you feel. Now, I actually married to a white woman. My wife, at Stacey M. Ritchie on Twitter, grew up on a farm where there was hardly any diversity in her community, but she is with me on this, and since she's moved to St. Louis in the last 10 years, she's been as appalled as I am at just the racism that's blatantly on display here in the area. But one thing that... We have definitely noticed. My wife again grew up in very low level of diversity, and yet one of her sisters married a black guy, and they have a biracial son, and they may have other kids down the road. And then on my side of the family, my brother married a girl from Mexico, and they have a biracial daughter, and they're going to have another one on the way. And my wife was pointing out that, you know, even though she did nothing to increase the diversity of her family, I mean, she married a white guy, we have two white kids. Her family is still growing more diverse, just because that's the way that culture is shifting right now. And I have a feeling that as the present generation moves out of power and moves out of Fox News viewership and out of the ability to influence the public discourse so much, and as the next generation, which is much more racially diverse and much more tolerant about other ideas and other groups of people, as that group moves into power, some of these issues are going to naturally diminish. Now, they're not going to go away. They're going to diminish because there'll be more people that are willing in positions of power to take a stand on them.
Hmm.
But the road to get there, however, is going to be long. And we still have a lot of institutions that we need to break down, and we have a lot of institutions that we need to disempower. And that is going to take a lot of conscious work on our part. We can't just expect the tides of time to do all the work for us, because the tides of time haven't done all the work for us, even since the 1960s. You know, here in St. Louis, we have this tradition called the Veiled Prophet. You might have read about it, because
yeah.
There was recently a protest at the Veiled Prophet Ball in St. Louis. But what the Veiled Prophet is it's a long-running tradition. It comes from the 1800s, where there is this person who kind of represents these values of white elitism. And they used to have, on the 4th of July, they would have a Veiled Prophet parade where the Veiled Prophet would ride through town almost a KKK-looking uniform. But, you know, he was veiled, he was secretive. And we also had the Veiled Prophet Fair, or the VP Fair. And that went on until 1992, when they finally were sort of embarrassed by this whole Veiled Prophet idea here in St. Louis. And changed the name of the fair to the Fair St. Louis, and changed the parade to just be a 4th of July parade. And yet we still have the Veiled Prophet. We still have the Veiled Prophet Ball every year, and the same white elite people that supported it before it kind of became out of fashion continue to go to the Veiled Prophet Ball. So that vestige of institutional racism is still there, and it needs to go away. We need to completely dismantle it. Just because it's not as public as it used to be doesn't mean that it's gone. And so that's the work that I think we really have ahead of us, changing our structure and changing our systems to embrace the values of the younger generation and to embrace the values of a more diverse America, and an America where white people are increasingly going to be a minority group. That's something that we really have to fix ahead of time, is to make sure that the systems are ready for that change.
Yeah, and you're right. The last statistic I saw was 2040, that, you know, white folk will be a minority within this country in terms of population. But I feel like part of that is what we're seeing, why some white people are fighting so hard, right? They see the writing on the wall just like we do, and they're struggling to try to maintain that power, right, to maintain their supremacy, for lack of a better word, right?
Oh, absolutely. Well, and I mentioned to you, I wanted to tell you a story. Do you mind if I take a minute to tell a story
please, Sean, about
my own upbringing? So as I was growing up, I grew up here in the St. Louis area for most of my life. We were military, so we moved around, but we settled here in the St. Louis area, and we lived right next to East St. Louis, Illinois, which East St. Louis used to be the crown gem of the Metro East. The Metro East is the Illinois portion of the St. Louis area. East St. Louis was this beautiful place. It had all these old Victorian homes. It was on Route 66. And because of a large number of factors, and too complex to go into right now, there was a white flight in the 1970s and early 80s that left it being one of the worst inner city areas in the entire country, comparable to parts of Washington, D.C., or to Detroit, or, you know, places like that. It is really, really bad. And when I was a kid in the 1990s, my parents decided to start a church ministry down there. They were very conflicted about all of the racism going on in the area. My parents are both from the South, but they both rejected the racism of their culture, and they really wanted to go down there and help through a church ministry. So they built a program called Saturday School, where the idea was that they would go down and they would provide supplementary education to black disadvantaged youth every Saturday. And the first day that we went down there, they brought me and my two younger brothers as well as kids. I think I was about 12 years old. The first day we went down there, no kids showed up. It was a very well-meaning program, but nobody came because it didn't sound like anything that they were particularly interested in. And so we worked very hard over the next year to build up a group of kids that would come to this program. But even so, we were coming in as white people trying to instill on them white educational values that they just weren't that interested in. And in fact, they would even bring in the youth group from my church, which is in a suburban white area, to come in and try to interact with these kids, and we had nothing in common with them. We had no ability to really communicate with them or talk to them. We kind of looked down on them because we were told that they were poor and in inner city, and you know, a lot of them had holes in their clothes, or they didn't smell that great, or there was one kid that had an infection of worms, you know, I mean, all kinds of awful things. We went down there as white saviors, and what we wound up doing over the course of that year was changing this from being an educational program to just basically a glorified Sunday school where we sang songs about Jesus and read the Bible and gave them some sandwiches and sent them off on their day. And the program was not only ineffective, but I think it actually caused many of the people involved with it to start to have contempt for the community down there because they felt like, well, gee, we can't even go down there and offer them free education. You know, they're not even interested in that. We just have to do a very basic missionary stance. What I learned from that growing up was, first of all, my parents were very well-meaning, and it was alarming to me as I reflected on it later on in life how well-meaning they were, and yet how discouraged they were by what they were doing. You know, they did something that they meant to do a lot of good, and they wound up not only being discouraged but having contempt. And then the other thing, too, is that my parents haven't returned down there really since. They lost interest in any kind of aid or activism down there. And, in fact, I think it actually kind of hardened them against that community a little bit. And I say that with a lot of love for my parents, but at the same time recognizing that my parents aren't supporting the Ferguson movement. My parents think that that my wife and I are crazy to be involved in this. They have no amount of empathy or sympathy for what's been going on recently. And I think that a lot of that has to do with their wrong intentions when they tried to get involved in this from the get-go. They looked at a group of people and felt like they could save them, and when they found out that they couldn't, they instead kind of hardened against them and felt this contempt that has lived with them for many years since.
Yeah, and almost like you said, it did a disservice on multiple levels, right? It didn't do what they thought it was going to do, and because it didn't help in the way that they wanted and expected it to help, it kind of calloused them from doing maybe more of that work, right?
Absolutely. Well, and you know, my parents live in an area that the demographics are increasingly becoming more diverse, and their area was a very nice area. It still is a very nice area, but there's a lot of black people in the East St. Louis area that don't want to send their kids to the schools there anymore. So they're finding ways to move to these other communities so that they can send their kids to decent schools. And I am always disappointed when I hear my parents resentful of that. My mom's a teacher in the public schools, and she has reasons for being resentful of it, but they're not reasons that I sympathize with. My charge to her is, understand the opportunity you have here. Don't look at this as a burden, but she doesn't see it that way.
Mm. Yeah, it's tough. Tough. You mentioned, not to pivot, and I don't have any real anything to add to that. But I think it's a great example of, you know, the best intentions can sometimes be cut. And I wouldn't say that this is a similar to Tui. I don't think your mom and dad went in with, you know, white savior and, you know, they weren't trying to assimilate and white privilege kind of stuff. But even the best intentions, you know, even, and I'm guilty. I'll use I statements. I've had the best intentions. I've made mistakes. You know, the very first national moment of silence, Feminista Jones started it. My wife organized one here locally. It was, I think, maybe 5 days after Mike Brown's killing, right? So it might have been like Thursday, I don't know what that was, August like 14th or something. And it was this national moment of silence, all on social media, Facebook, Twitter. You know, people aren't even really talking about this. And here we've got in Philadelphia, I think it was 600-700 people show up at Love Park. So we had planned to read names of individuals that have been killed through extrajudicial violence. We planned on having a moment of silence, and there was no megaphone, there was no speaker, there was no sort of, you know, there's all these different people. And now when we go to meetings for our Philadelphia to Ferguson task force, we've got, you know, PERP and Power and CCOP and all the, you know, union reps, all these different groups are coming in and working together. But at that moment, 5 days after Mike Brown's death, it was a little bit unorganized, discordant.
Right.
And I, you know, hey, I'll say this, when you know better, you do better. And I, all these things we're talking about, I'm going through these internally, I'm going through this evolution. I make mistakes, and I made one at this national moment of silence in that there was a need to get attention and to sort of, you know, hey, let's do this moment of silence. Let's read these names. And my wife saying, hey, you know, can you help get attention? There's no megaphone. I'm tall. I'm 6 foot something. I'm kind of loud. I stand up on a thing and I, you know, scream, you know, hey, and I get everyone's attention. I'm on the megaphone, right? White guys leading this moment. And I thought in the moment, hey, it needs to be done. Somebody needs to do it. Great, I'll do it. And I didn't think anything bad about it. And wouldn't you know it, the news media was there. There was NBC, CBS, Telemundo, every news outlet was there. They spoke to my wife. They spoke to other, you know, people of color and leaders. And, you know, they interviewed tons and tons and tons of people. Every single gosh darn station had me with a little bit of a, you know, I gave him a soundbite. I wasn't trying to, you know, didn't mean to, but it was like, you know, every 28 hours, a person of color is killed. And these are the names. Let's read them. And that was on every flip and station. And right away, I was like, I was just mad at myself. I was disappointed. I thought, God, here's the, you know, at this event, there was probably 700-800 people. The vast majority were black, right? The organizers were all black women, Feminista Jones, my wife, you know, a few other people she's working. And who got on the friggin' news? The white guy, you know? And I just was so frustrated by it. But I was like, you know what? I see now. I know that that narrative can be played out whether I want it to or not. And I can, you know, help them do that by giving them a soundbite, or I can kind of take up less space and be in background and do different things. So I, you know, I've learned, I've made mistakes. But I think the key is to understand and to keep, to don't give up, to keep trying, vow not to make that same mistake twice. You know, certainly no one in the movement has, you know, they haven't blocked me or haven't said, you know, damn it, very white guy, get out of here. You know, you did that one thing 3.5 months ago. But I know better, so I'm going to try to do better. You know, and that's all we really can do, I guess.
Well, and I think that that attitude, exhibiting that attitude really matters a lot. You know, I, in this movement, I'm a background player, and I'm very happy to be a background player because my wife and I made a rule very early on that we would demonstrate, but we could not get arrested. We have two small children. We both have jobs. You know, we have a very important responsibility to our family that we need to honor before we go get arrested for the sake of getting arrested.
Understandably.
Yeah. So we made a decision that we would only go to events that were safe, relatively. That's difficult in St. Louis because the police are so aggressive here, but that were relatively safe, where we weren't going to be concerned about, you know, getting tossed in jail or getting beaten up by the police. And we also made a decision that we were going to try our best to support Operation Helper Hush, which is a group that we really like and support that Charles Wade runs, rather than to try to divide our attention among all of the different groups that are out here. And in doing that, it's actually been kind of liberating because we don't feel the need to get up front and center anywhere, and we do have the ability to blend into the background. And, you know, when I started this, a lot of what I had to do and say, many of the people that were on the ground had no idea who I was, and that was just fine. I was more concerned about amplifying them. Now, many of them I've become friends with, or at least Twitter friends with, and they amplify me sometimes, but they amplify me because I'm saying things in support of them. And I'm totally fine with that. I'm totally fine if a friend like Charles Wade retweets things that I'm saying because he feels that they're really on point. But, you know, I always want to bring it back to, I'm only saying these things to boost and support the people that are doing the real struggle, that are doing the real activism, that are doing the real work. And, you know, Charles is a great example. I might say things about how great the work he is doing, and it's tremendous. I mean, we just had a holiday party a week ago that he sponsored, and during that holiday party, he gave away a car to a protester in need. And he announced that there were several protesters that are homeless that he's arranging housing for. And, I mean, he really is doing some incredible work for these folks. He reminded us that there are 40 people that are still in jail that have been pretty much forgotten, and that we're going to do our best to remember those people through sending them cards and tidings through the holidays and things like that. So I jumped on Twitter and talked about all of that because he was busy and he didn't have time. And some would look at that and say, oh, well, look, the white guy's trying to take credit for what the black activists are doing. Well, but, you know, I was very clear in what I was saying. I'm impressed and I'm humbled and I'm awed by Charles. And that's why no one really felt that way about what I was saying, because they understood it was coming from a place where I admire him deeply. And I want to celebrate what he's doing. And, in fact, he was even joking how he loved the idea that I compared him to Oprah, because that was what he felt like. And, you know, I even was able to add a little bit to what he was doing and saying to make him feel better. And that's, I think, what our role as supporters really needs to be, to support, to build up, to encourage, to elevate, to amplify. And we can be a part of the story, but let's not be the focus of the story. Let's always turn it back to the folks that are really in the struggle, that are really working hard. And, you know, that's something that I think we all can learn from the mistakes we made. I've certainly made mistakes. I've probably made at least a mistake a day, but we've all gotten better at it. And what tends to happen over time is that the community tends to trust you and recognize you as a supporter, and not to question you if you step out of line a little bit. They just might let you know, yeah, get back in line. And that's ultimately, I think, where we as supporters all want to be and need to be.
I totally agree. Completely and totally agreed. It's just, I think was it our podcast maybe where Charles was saying that white people are just so unfamiliar with taking a secondary role.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, there's a lot of truth to that. And so there's, you know, and I'll just, again, speak for myself. I'm a white man. I've got all kinds of privilege. And in my life, I've been successful in a multitude of ways by generally, you know, taking my privilege and working hard. But, you know, I know that I have the privilege, and I know that I can get the job done when I need to. But what we're talking about with this social justice work, this community activism work, the you know, dismantling this system of supremacy, boy, oh boy, it's not going to be, you know, one person, two people. It's going to be thousands of people, tens of thousands of people working in concert in multiple different ways. So I even struggle with, you know, historically, I'm used to, right, my own reinforcement history is, you know, okay, I'm a white guy, and I'm going to put my nose to the grindstone, and I'm going to get it done. And it's just, that's not going to work with this problem, right?
Well, and you know, I know we're nearing a time where we need to wrap up here. So I always like to think about action. And this is part of what I do in my professional life, as well as what I do in my personal life. When we've had a discussion, I like to think about what are the next steps? What can we do to take what we've learned and move forward? And a question that I have for you, something that we can discuss here for a moment, is, if you don't mind me taking over for just a moment,
John,
is we have this white privilege. We have this, I call it a superpower, you know, where we're able to be almost invisible until we speak up.
Mm.
And we have an ability also to influence the system in ways that our black friends who are struggling do not. So what can we do to leverage that white privilege? We talk about minimizing it when we're supporting the struggle, but we also have an ability to use it to support the struggle in different ways. And in what ways can we use that white privilege to influence and disrupt the system in ways that are different from what's already being done?
And that's a great question, and I'm glad you asked it. We've talked about it at a couple different groups and Facebook, and you know some of the things that have been mentioned. So when we're at protest action, leveraging our privilege. So instead of holding up a sign that says "Black Lives Matter" or "Worse, I can't breathe," holding up a sign that says "White silence equals." Complicity. White silence is consent to police violence. So using your white privilege in a slightly different way when we're at these sort of protest actions. We've also talked about so the protest actions that are happening and increasingly, and I love what was just done in Minneapolis, they're increasingly disrupting the status quo. They're increasingly making the status quo uncomfortable. And I think we as white people can get away with that even more so. And we could, so I'm thinking of like the St. Louis Symphony with the Requiem for Mike Brown. I'd love to see white people do something like that in their churches. Right? Stop a church service and sing the Requiem for Mike Brown. Sing the, and I forget the name of it, but the Now That I'm in the Struggle, I Can't Breathe, Samuel Jackson kind of famously threw that gauntlet down. But, doing something to disrupt the sort of comfortable nature that we as white people can get in sort of this movement and waking more people up. And part of that Tumblr I'm creating and hoping to do is just that. It's not solely for white people, but my sincere hope is that a lot of white people will see that as something that they can do. Okay, great. Here's an action. Post this on Facebook. It highlights a racial disparity, invites people to, let's talk. Please talk to me about this. And there's even, I've given some information. When someone does talk to you, thank you for talking, taking the time to talk to me about racial bias in America. So I'm hoping that, one, dialogue, talking to people. I think self-education is huge. So if there's people listening and I've said this on Twitter and Facebook a bunch, if you can tell white people, I know you can tell something doesn't sit well. Something's not right. It feels off. Maybe you can't describe it. Maybe you can't put your finger on it. Maybe you can't articulate it, but you know something is not quite right. And if that's all you're able to get to and you're not able to, from that point, take any action or make any sort of declarative statements, the responsibility for you as an individual who's uncomfortable is to educate, is to learn, is to go out and read, expand your social networks, expand the multiculturalism in your life, listen to people of color, consume and absorb information that helps you understand racial bias and privilege. And I don't know if you've got other thoughts, but I'd love to hear it. I think this is the right place to talk about what we that have privilege can do to leverage that in a positive way for the movement.
Well, one thing that I think we as white people don't do enough of is getting involved with our authorities. So one thing that I've learned very painfully through this process is that if I approach a police officer, I get a very different reaction than if a black friend does. Even if that black friend is equally as educated and as professional and as well-dressed or anything as I am, I'm going to get a different reaction than my black friend will. And we have an ability to walk up to police and not trigger their alarms the same way. We also have an ability to talk to our public officials and not trigger an alarm the same way. Here in St. Louis, we have a problem where whenever a group of black people congregate, they're immediately assumed to be Ferguson protesters, and City Hall is shut down. It happens. But when a group of white people congregate, they're just assumed to be, maybe they're baseball fans or football fans. Nobody gets too worried about them. So we have an ability and our privilege to speak up to our authorities in a way that isn't easily done if you're a person of color. And I think that's something that we need to be doing more of, and we need to be more deliberate about. One of the things that I struggle with is I don't actually live in St. Louis proper. I live in the Metro East, so I feel off going and talking to Mayor Slay's office or to Chief Belmar or to Chief Dotson to tell them my feelings. But why? Is that just because I'm uncomfortable because I don't live in the area, or because I'm uncomfortable because it's a convenient excuse not to talk to them? And I've definitely written them letters and sent them emails and things like that. Why can't I go and meet with them in person as well? And there are other opportunities like that as well. We could be talking to our congressional officials. We could be talking to our local representatives. We could be talking to people in the Attorney General's office or the Department of Justice. As white folks, we have an ability to to say something to them that they may listen to a little bit differently, because they may say, well, gee, you know, if this white person is talking about this, maybe this is really a problem. Maybe it's not just a minority group complaining about unfair treatment. Maybe there really is something unfair going on. So that's something that I'm going to try to challenge myself to do more of in 2015. And certainly as these out-of-control narratives continue to expand, I mean, even today with Antonio Martin, it's getting out of control with what the police are saying. We need to be speaking up to higher levels of power beyond just being out in the streets. Not that we don't need to be in the streets. We should be, but we need to also reach the people that aren't necessarily listening to what those protests have to say.
Yeah, and you've got a great Tumblr. Which side are you on, friend? Is that correct?
Yes, which is sorely in need of some new art, new content. I'm hoping to work on that in the next couple of weeks.
Wonderful. I know you've got a lot of suggestions, and I think number one or two amongst them is just what you're saying, speaking out. And I feel so for me, so you've listed your sort of goal for 2015 is to be speaking up to higher, you know, in sales we say get to the decision maker, right? Who holds the purse strings? So you want to go higher up the ladder with sort of who you're communicating with and speaking to. And I think that's laudable and terrific for me. And I, you know, it's interesting. I use Twitter in some ways. I don't want to say anonymously. I'm not trying to hide. I haven't been like doxxed or anything. But I work from home. I've got an employer that, you know, lets me do my job, and I talk to him twice a year. So he might not even know or care what I'm doing with social justice. But you know, this ability to hide, right? This ability to not speak up when I'm uncomfortable. It's there. And so for me, the challenge for myself is to be unreasonable, right? So that little voice in my head that says, oh, don't say anything. You know, someone just made a comment that was insensitive, but they didn't mean it like that. And, oh, it'll be impolite to kind of stop this whole, you know, dinner discussion and have a discussion about why that was inappropriate. And all these little voices in my head say, don't do this, don't do this. I'm going to be unreasonable. I'm going to tell that little voice, stop it. And I'm going to, as a goal, to anytime I see, hear, or feel something is inappropriate, to speak out. And as a white person, I've said this before, I know the world is moving, and I don't know how fast it's changing, but I'll know for me the sort of line in the sand is when more white people are openly comfortable speaking out. Like right now, there's even an air of if I speak out, I'm thought of as the weird one. People kind of shout me down. I'm, you know, how dare you not be more racist, Drew? Like, you know what I mean? Like, speaking out can sometimes be uncomfortable, and I'm committed to being as uncomfortable as often as possible, just simply as a not because I think it's the right thing to do or I want to be seen, but because that's who I want to be. And I think that more people, when they become that way, more and more white people will be comfortable seeing other white people that way. They'll be comfortable being that way themselves. And, you know, hopefully we change the world. But so that's for me is being more willing to be outspoken at all intervals, to not have any excuse. And again, as a white male, you know, there isn't the same fear, there isn't the same problems that a person of color has. You know, a black individual at an office speaking out, they might get called to the HR. They might get fired. You know, out and about in a public space, they could literally be attacked and killed. Probably not going to happen to a very white guy. I can speak out, and worst that's going to happen is somebody's going to, you know, think bad of me. Okay, you know?
Absolutely. Well, and that's something that we really have to be conscious of, is that our actions, sometimes when we go against the grain, are watched even more carefully than when someone who's a person of color speaks out. They're kind of expected to speak out. They're the oppressed group. And whether we acknowledge that they're oppressed or not, they're expected to have an opinion that they are. That's just kind of the way our culture works. But when a white person speaks out, I mean, unless you're considered to be the kooky, outsider, liberal kind of person that nobody else in the office listens to, you have an opportunity to change hearts and change minds. And I'll finish up my portion of what we're going to talk about with just one quick example. I work in a very small office, but we're actually a pretty diverse group. And our office manager the other day was talking about how she collects receipts, and that sometimes she feels like she's the receipt Nazi. Well, the problem is that the president of our company is Orthodox Jewish, and he actually has family members who actually perished in the Holocaust. I immediately walked up to her and said, "Can you please be more sensitive about what you say? Because that is not a sensitive thing to say among someone that's Orthodox Jewish." And she wasn't used to being called out like that, but the rest of the day, she was very careful, and she even told me she felt terrible about what she said. She'd never realized that she had said something that was so insensitive to someone that she respects so much, the president of our company, is a wonderful guy. So just being willing to speak up and be on point about that, and not to be rude, not to call her a racist, and not to project all these other things on her, but to just really make her understand that what she said was out of line, it changed her behavior, and it made her more sensitive to it. And that's something that I think we in our white privilege don't do enough. We're uncomfortable doing it. We shouldn't be. We need to make sure that when we view these interactions, that we're reminding people that this stuff is real.
Yeah. And in fact, I had my own instance where I was sort of being reserved and not wanting to talk about this. And I finally was like, you know what? Okay. I'm gonna just, you know, it was a different group. It was a, you know, not related to social justice. It was another group here in Philadelphia. And I didn't know the individuals. We were kind of meeting all day kind of thing. And I finally said, you know, this is what I'm doing. This is what I'm struggling with. And there was someone in a group of eight of us around this table that said, oh, I do the same work and I'm doing this and do that. And here I thought, my God, I've wasted all this time thinking, you know, maybe this guy, someone's got a, you know, police hat on, someone's got, you know, I don't know who is in this room. I don't want to speak up and be uncomfortable. But what really happened is I wasted time being able to connect with somebody who's doing the exact same work. So I'm committed to being much more outspoken and unreasonable in my day-to-day life because it's needed. You know, I think, like I said, the more we know, the more I see white people speaking up about this, that'll be my litmus test. I know that the world is pivoting and changing. But I think we're right at the top of an hour plus, and I want to be respectful of your time, Sean. And I know you've got the kids at home and Stacy. So thank you so much for being here on Christmas Eve. You've done, if the listeners, I hope, enjoyed it. I personally have really appreciated you being, as you said, the doctor is in, my therapist for some of this stuff, because it really just, it's for me and my wife, it's just so strange. You know, I can't understand what she's dealing with and her pain, and I can't pretend to understand it. I don't want to bother her with what I'm going through. So we're both working in this, but in sort of different ways at the same time, but not really kind of talking about some things. So it's a bit of a strange space. So I appreciate your, you know, talk to me about, you know, white people problems, which are minor.
Right back at you. And, you know, I'm very respectful of the work that you and your wife do, and extremely proud of your wife for the massive role that she played in the Ferguson Response website that she set up and was able to get organized all these protests that went on over the last month. So you guys are doing awesome work. And more than that, I really do appreciate your voice and your just attempt to be genuine and to share you know, your own feelings. And I will tell you, my wife in particular enjoys listening to your other podcast where you're talking with your wife, because there are times where my wife bites her tongue about things that I say about women, and she has to kind of remind me, hey, wait a minute, you know, you're a male with privilege too, and you don't always think about how women feel in these situations, and she hears your wife doing that to you all the time, so she enjoys hearing that.
Yeah, I don't know if we podcast about it, but that, I've said this frequently, my lens for racial matters is really, you know, it's focused. I can see it clearly, but for patriarchy, for male privilege, I'm blind as a bat, you know. And I did it where I mocked someone's clothing. We're watching Jeopardy, we taped them, and we had, you know, five episodes, so we're watching them binging, and the woman won a couple days in a row. And day one I made a comment about her dress, and day two I made a comment about her hair, and day three I made, you know, some other comment, and my wife very politely said, you know Drew, I don't think you would have done that if it was a man. And guess what I did? You know, oh, no way. Are you calling me a misogynist? Oh, that's, oh, no way. I can't believe you'd say that to me. I'm your husband. You know me better than that. And it was like, you know, it took not a long time, but maybe an hour. I was like, oh, for crying out loud. Did I just get defensive and belligerent? And she's so right. You know, and it's just, I'm just that blind to my male privilege. I have plenty of male privilege and plenty of white privilege. I get and see my white privilege. My male privilege sometimes just sails right over my head. It's hard. I'm struggling. I got to just keep doing better. You know, I'll keep falling down and picking myself up.
Well, and we'll all become better people out of this if that's the perspective that we have. So good luck to you, and I'll be doing the same myself.
Terrific. Well, here's the outro, and then we'll let you go. One person can change the world. Love with no limits. Feel everything. Our intensity is not a fault, but a superpower. Remember, you should help, not hinder. Support, don't supplant. Cooperate, don't co-opt. Solidarity, not charity. Reveal, don't conceal our truth. Take action. Make mistakes. Learn. Retool. Do better. Thanks, Sean. Have a great day.
Thank you.